Hello, this is Ray Boland, your host today for ID the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design. Today, our guest is Dr. Cornelius Hunter, author of the book Darwin's God and a blog by the same name. Dr. Hunter has commented in the last few weeks on an article that appeared in Science, the Journal of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, or AAAS. This article reported that a virus that infects the bacterium E. coli evolved the ability to use a new method to invade the cell and that it needed four mutations to do so. So, Dr. Hunter, welcome to ID the Future.
Well, thank you, Ray. Glad to be here.
Well, Dr. Hunter or Cornelius, can you give us a quick summary of how a virus infects bacteria?
Well, it's a big topic, and there's different kinds of viruses and different kinds of bacteria, so we'll keep it simple here. The basic idea that's important for this paper that you talked about is that a virus needs to find a place on the surface of the bacteria to attach. And there are conveniently all sorts of receptor proteins or membrane proteins on the surface of the bacteria that the bacteria uses for good purposes, which the virus exploits. And so it's able to invade the bacterium via these protein channels. The key is that the virus has to find a protein to bind to. Then so it has a protein of its own that's already set up to achieve that binding. It's like it has a lock and a key sort of thing.
Okay, so the experiment published just a few years ago showed that the bacteriophage, which is a virus that infects bacteria, is called Lambda, evolved the ability to use a different protein to use as an attachment site to begin infection. Could you give us an overview of the experiment?
Well, it was a very ingenious, clever experiment where they took this bacterium, the E. coli that you referenced, and made it so that the virus was unable to use its usual surface protein. So it couldn't really work its invasion through the normal route, except on rare occasions. So you didn't kill off the virus population altogether. You kept it going just a little bit. So it was kind of on life support. That encouraged or allowed for the possibility for the virus to find other routes into the bacterium. And that's how they kind of set that up, a very ingenious, clever experiment. Of course, this was all in a laboratory environment where you have large populations of bacterium, large populations of viruses that are all well-fed, and the bacterium are nice, fat, happy targets waiting to be exploited by the virus. So it's not any kind of attempt to reflect reality. This isn't a simulation of how evolution could actually have worked. It's a very artificial experiment.
Okay. And as we talked about very briefly in the opening, the beginning of the show, we mentioned that the bacteriophage experienced four particular mutations to allow it to utilize a different protein on the surface of the bacterium as an attachment site. So why the need for four mutations, do you think?
Right. Good question, right? So this gets to the whole problem of protein-protein binding, which is a good example of a problem for evolution. And Michael Behe has written about this in his book, The Edge of Evolution. Biology is just full of all kinds of complexities that are far beyond the abilities of evolution. Now, by the way, Ray, I have nothing against evolution per se. If that's what the science says, fine, I'm all for it. The problem is it just doesn't make sense on the science. And it's really kind of sad to see evolutionists continue to kind of fight and contradict the science. In the case of protein-protein binding, so most people remember that, you know, our bodies are full of proteins. You learned about that in high school. Cells are constantly making proteins to do all kinds of jobs. But it's a lot more complicated than just that, because proteins don't just go off and do a job. They work with other proteins in big machines, molecular machines. So proteins are constantly binding to each other, forming these protein machines. So proteins have to be able to stick together to some extent. So that's what we refer to as protein-protein binding. They, on the surface, they have to match up and both structurally as well as chemically kind of fit together. This requires half a dozen or more amino acids on both proteins to kind of fit together. And so you need to have the right sequence of amino acids to work this binding. So it's a very difficult design to achieve from random mutations. Because if you have just one or two or three of those amino acids in place, it's not really going to do the job. You'll get some binding affinity, but it's just not enough to produce the function that's needed to get that Mielecki machine to work. And so what Michael Behe talked about years ago was just this kind of basic minimum functionality that you need when proteins bind together is way beyond the resources of evolutionary theory to randomly mutate and get that many, because like I said, one or two isn't going to do the job. You have to have more mutations, and that's just real hard for evolution to do. What they did in this experiment, again, with this artificial, very cleverly designed experiment, they demonstrated the truth of what I just said. So they showed that you need to have four mutations in order for this virus to attach to a new membrane protein and find a different way into the cell. It had to have kind of a minimum of four mutations to make that work. If it had three or two of those needed mutations, it didn't work. It didn't have a sufficient sticking power. So that was a good finding of the paper. It kind of confirmed what is well known, but you know, it's nice that they showed that. Now, they were able to encourage the virus to achieve those four mutations. And so evolutionists are pointing to that as, hey, here's an example of evolution occurring. It worked. Well, first of all, again, it's a very artificial environment. This would never occur in the real world like this because everything's in the laboratory. But it's worse than that. The way that it achieved those four mutations was a lucky strike, so to speak. The key point here is that the new membrane protein that the virus attached to was very similar to the first one. So it's not really a big change. And so it's no big surprise that mutations that helped the virus attach to the new one also helped it attach to the old one. It made it even stronger and better so it could work even better on the old one. So you didn't have the need for these four new mutations occurring out of nowhere. A couple of them could occur and help it with its old function, and it needed help because, like I said earlier, that avenue was mostly shut down. So the paper described this as a kind of a lucky serendipity that three of the four mutations occurred to help it with its current existing function. No surprise there. Nothing. It's not developing a new protein-protein binding interface. It's simply strengthening its existing one. That happens very easily. Then all it needed was one more mutation to achieve this binding to a different entryway into the cell, which wasn't blocked, worked well, and then the virus could take off. So none of this is any big surprise, and none of it challenges what Michael Behe had talked about years ago. It's a great study, very interesting, nothing really too surprising.
Now, it seems that many evolutionists have highlighted this experiment as a wonderful verification of the power of mutation and natural selection. And recently, this very experiment was highlighted by a scholar from BioLogos, the organization dedicated to promoting the validity of evolution, to Christians both in and out of science. And you had some interaction on their website over this experiment, so could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, right, Ray. Yeah, so I did interact with evolutionists at the BioLogos site on this paper because they brought it up, and I thought it would be good to clarify the science and then get to the bottom of this and explain to them that this science does not support the conclusions they were coming to. And so we had an interesting interchange, and well, unfortunately it just confirmed everything that I've been saying here, that evolutionists are not evaluating the science in a theory-neutral approach. What you find is evidences are always interpreted in ways to help the theory, and if it's a problem for the theory, the evidence is reinterpreted somehow. And like I said, it's fine. If evolution supports the theory, hey, I'm all for it. Let's talk about that. But if it doesn't, then we need to talk about that too, and not to exaggerate or take evidence beyond what it can say. Unfortunately, there is a pattern. There's a trend. Evolutionists are driven by non-scientific factors, non-scientific influences. There is a desire for the theory to be true in spite of the science, not because of the science. There are all kinds of problems. It really contradicts the science. And this is just another case where the evidence is not interpreted in a neutral way, just let the cards fall where they may. So we talked about that on the BioLogos website, and it was really an unfortunate example, once again, of how the evolutionists really have another agenda going on.
Well, one last thing I'd like to bring up and see what we might be able to accomplish here. One of the things brought up in the interchange on the BioLogos website was the notion that our own immune system is able to generate antibodies to an enormous range of possible invaders and different kinds of molecules, and there's a capacity to, in a sense, mutate or interchange the genes that are responsible for producing the antibodies, so we can have this incredible diversity of responses to lots of different types of invaders. And they seem to appeal to this as direct evidence that, again, mutation, natural selection can alter protein binding sites fairly easily. Can you help us understand that?
Yeah, sure, Ray. I mean, again, this is an astonishing argument. I'm flabbergasted that evolutionists would make such a specious, utterly fallacious argument. For people who don't understand the science, this can be very deceptive. Absolutely. The vertebrate immune system generates and is able to generate protein-protein binding interfaces all the time. As you mentioned, when we have a virus or a sickness, an illness, our immune system goes after it. And one of the many techniques that it has is to bind to those foreign invaders and get rid of them. A very fantastic system, incredible system, for which evolution has no explanation. Literally, there is no explanation for how this system could have arisen from that random mutation. The last thing evolutionists should be doing is referring to this as some sort of evidence for evolution. It makes no sense. But beyond that, this idea that, well, the immune system, the vertebrate immune system, is generating these protein-protein binding sequences and is doing it by chance, therefore, we have evidence that evolution can do this. How can you possibly say evolution can't do this when we have laboratory evidence for this every day in our own bodies? Well, this is like comparing an SR-71 supersonic aircraft with an inchworm. These are two completely different problems. Our immune system is designed and set up to do this on a very rapid, high-speed, supersonic basis. The experiments are done at a very high rate of speed, and the feedback is essentially immediately there. None of this holds true for evolution. It's much slower. If the hypothetical evolutionary process relies on these random mutations, which are much more uncommon, much rarer, they take place over ultimately eons of time or the generations, and the feedback is slow. So there just is no comparison at all. The protein-protein binding problem is not at all resolved by our immune system. And it's just sad to see evolutionists bringing this up. And for people who don't understand science, it can be very deceptive. And that's one of the reasons why I've been interacting with them, just to bring this out so people aren't confused by this.
Well, this indeed has been a fascinating discussion, and from my perspective, it seems that even when an experiment seems to offer evidence of mutation and natural selection producing something significant, well, it just seems to turn out to be much less than the hype. So thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Hunter.
Thank you, Ray. Appreciate it.
For ID the Future, this is Ray Boland, and thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute, 2016. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org or idthefuture.com.